the late 1960s, while still in college, I remember having a heated argument with a fellow classmate in my basic psychology class. I insisted and believed strongly that much of human behavior was genetically or biochemically determined, while my classmate clung to the very popular theories of B.F. Skinner, which attributed human behavior to basic behavioral theory. That is, our actions are conditioned through the mechanisms of reward, reinforcement, and punishment. Well, 40 years later, and we're still in the nature-nurture debate in human psychology. But we've come so much farther in our understanding of the nature part and the role of biology in how we behave. That's especially true in the study of mental health. And right here at Upstate Medical University, we are engaged in some groundbreaking research to unlock the biological secrets of mental illness. Joining us this morning to share some of this research with us is Dr. Stephen Glatt, the director of the Psychiatric Genetic Epidemiology and Neurobiology Laboratory. Welcome, Dr. Glatt.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
It would seem to me you should have a shorter name.
Well, we actually do. It reduces to the Psych Gene Lab, and we're the only Psych Gene Lab in the world.
Well, that's great. So, Psych Gene, welcome.
Thank you.
So, where do we stand today in the nurture-nature debate?
Well, you hit the nail on the head saying that we've come a long way in understanding the nature part of things, and we're still in the throes of that debate. We used to think that it had to be nature or nurture, but now the debate is more centered on how much of it is nature and how much of it is nurture. How do they work together, genes and environment working together to influence these traits like mental health and mental illness?
I guess there's not really one gene necessarily that's been determined to cause any particular illness. Is that the case?
Well, in the realm of psychiatric disorders, that's certainly the case. In what we call Mendelian disorders or single gene disorders like Huntington's disease, if you inherit the aberrant copy of the gene, you're going to get the disorder. We don't find genes like that in psychiatric illness. What we find actually are what we call susceptibility genes or risk genes that each increase your risk a little bit. And when you inherit a lot of these together, then you may be at a heightened risk and develop the disorder.
So you have the blueprint laid out at birth, so to speak, but whether it actually ever gets realized or comes to fruition is really a matter of the environment.
Well, it's also absolutely an effect of gene interacting with the environment. So no matter how much genetic susceptibility you've inherited, there's almost always, in all cases, some environmental factors that interact with those risk genes. So for some disorders that we study, like ADHD and autism, that onset very early in life, there's a very strong genetic component and probably not so much in the environment that influences them. But for other adult onset disorders like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, there is certainly a heritable component to people's susceptibility, but it's those stresses of late adolescence and early adulthood that often combine with the genetic susceptibility to precipitate an illness.
So tell me what epigenetics is, because I was reading a little bit in prep for this interview, and it seems like that's an important field now, or a way of understanding this whole connection.
Well, indeed. So when we think about nature and nurture again, we think that the genes are the nature part and the environment is the nurture part. And again, our understanding has evolved to the point where we think about nature-nurture interactions. But how does the environment interact with the genome? That's what the study of epigenetics is about.
So the way in which the environment actually makes the genes function a certain way.
Right. So the DNA that we inherit tells us what types of genes we're going to end up with. But the environment, through what we call epigenetic modifications, can change how much or how little of a gene is made. And that's just as important in many cases as what type of gene you're making.
So in your lab, well, first tell me about your lab and your department. What's your mission? What's your vision? What are you hoping to accomplish?
Well, our department is the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science, a great environment for doing research, and we have tons of support from our chairman, Dr. Mantosh Dhawan. He's the one who encouraged me to start the Psych Gene Lab here at Upstate after I came here from University of California, San Diego. And our vision in the lab is actually very broad. I was once told that if you set a very narrow vision for your work, you'll attain it and have nothing else to work toward. But if you set a broad vision, people may at first shake their head or dismiss it. But if you keep telling it to people and reiterating it, then you see people nodding their heads and agreeing, and you all work toward that common goal, it can be accomplished. So our vision is that ultimately we'll discover the causes of mental illnesses and develop protocols through which we can prevent people from having to suffer.
So it's treatment, prevention, early diagnosis, all of those things.
Indeed. We start with the premise of identifying possible risk factors and biomarkers. Then the concept is, can we identify these disorders as early as possible? Maybe even before the symptoms really take over somebody's life. And then the concept changes to early intervention. Can we treat someone sooner? And finally, ultimately, by the end of my life, I hope that we're in the position of preventing people who have inherited a susceptibility and maybe have had some untoward environmental risks from actually developing the disorder.
That's an incredible set of expectations and goals, and I applaud you for them. Tell me, your laboratory is engaged. I mean, at one point, we were talking earlier before the interview that you were doing more epidemiologic research, really just doing statistical analyses. And now you're actually hands-on doing basic science. And you mentioned it was called a wet lab?
Indeed.
How so? Tell me about that.
Well, I'm a dry lab scientist by training. Ever since my postdoctoral fellowship, I've been doing biostatistics and epidemiology because there are large data sets that have been collected over decades, really. And I've been delving into those data sets very deeply, discovering risk genes from the data. But I've always had to stop at that point and turn it over to others. But since we've come to Upstate, we've actually taken it a step further, built our own wet lab, got the lab coats on, the gloves, the pipettes, and actually working to try and find out the genes we've discovered in the dry lab, what's their biological functioning in human tissue, in human brain tissue, in animal models of the disorders, and in peripheral blood samples.
So when you say wet, what's wet?
Well, what's
wet is... Blood, tissue?
Indeed. The human tissues that we use, the reagents that we use, and the biohazards therein.
Yeah, so you're actually really working, manipulating, looking at the genes, analyzing them, and then trying to find out which ones are significant.
Indeed. DNA makes protein, ultimately. And so what we're doing in the lab is trying to find out how these aberrant DNAs change proteins in a faulty way.
Well, hold that thought. I want to hear much more about it. We're going to take a short break. We're going to be right back to learn more about biomedical research. I'm Linda Cohen, and this is HealthLink on Air, 570 WSYR. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with Dr. Stephen Glatt, biomedical researcher into the causes and markers of mental illness. While it's very, very interesting just before the break, talking about how these things work. But tell me what diseases are you working on right now in your lab?
We're studying a whole host of psychiatric and neurodevelopmental disorders, including bipolar disorder, depression, and substance use disorders. But the main two disorders we focus on are schizophrenia, which is typically an adult onset disorder, and autism, which is a very severe early childhood onset disorder.
And what exactly are you doing? I mean, just for the layperson, what do you do when you go into your lab in the morning?
Okay, well, we typically over a long period of time collect large samples of both families and unrelated individuals who both have the disease and who don't have the disease. We take blood samples from them, or if in the unfortunate circumstance that they should happen to die, we can get postmortem brain tissue from them. We analyze the DNA that they have, the messenger RNA that those genes make in their brains, in their blood, and we try and find statistically what genes are overrepresented or are made in abundance in people who have the disorder versus those who do not. Once we've identified those what we call candidate genes, then I bring them into the wet lab and we try and determine what the biological ramification or function is of having inherited one genotype versus a different genotype, or having too much of gene X or too little of gene X. What does that mean for the brain tissue?
Okay, and then how does that interact with the whole environmental part of it?
Well, most of the research that we do admittedly is focused on genes, but implicit in that is that there is some environmental interactor out there that we're not necessarily studying. We know from some of the latest research, for example, in major depression, that it's not just what gene you inherited, but perhaps what your early environmental stressors were like in the home. Was someone sexually abused? Were they physically abused, etc.? And that can potentiate the risk for depression in people who have a susceptible genotype. We're doing similar work in schizophrenia and autism. In schizophrenia, it's also focused on stressors, but more the stressors of late adolescence and early adulthood, like going away to college, finding significant others, having children, etc., that can interact with susceptible genotypes to put someone at imminent risk.
So the notion really is that you need to have the biological markers, you need to have the biological underpinnings, then the environment at various times in one's development can play a significant role. And the major stressor, the major environmental factor is stress?
Indeed. For schizophrenia, we've seen over and over again that stress can both push susceptible individuals into a psychotic episode or cause relapse among schizophrenics who are typically well-functioning. When they're exposed to massive amounts of stress, that can often precipitate a relapse.
It's very complex, though, because you would think, since stress is endemic in our society, if in fact stress had that kind of power, there'd be a lot more people running around with psychotic breaks.
Well, indeed, but stress isn't the only factor, and again, it's nature and nurture. So stress compounded with the susceptible genotype is what really is the cause in that case.
I understand that you've been honored recently with a recent award from NARSAD, the National Alliance for Research on Schizophrenia and Depression, which is a brain and behavioral research fund. But you've had a long history with them. This isn't the first award that you've gotten.
Indeed. Right? I would almost say that I attribute much of my success now to early funding from NARSAD. With funding from the National Institutes of Health kind of flatlining and research costs going through the roof, more and more young scientists are having to leave the field. But I got funding from NARSAD through a Young Investigator Award back in 2006, which allowed me to stay engaged in my research and also develop some independence from my mentors, concoct my own ideas, and, you know, see the benefits of that, as well as take responsibility when things turn out less than perfect.
It sounds like a wonderful organization. This is a not-for-profit, is that correct?
Indeed. And it's an A-plus rated charity in that every dollar that's donated to NARSAD goes directly to research. There are two separate foundations set up to support all administrative costs of the agency so that every dollar a donor contributes goes straight to research
grants. That's incredible. And how did this all get started? Do you know the background with NARSAD or...?
NARSAD is an alliance of mostly advocates and family members of people who have mental illnesses.
Wow.
And they've been doing this for decades now, giving almost $250 million away for scientific research. I recently was in New York City receiving an award from NARSAD and the Sidney R. Baird Jr. Foundation for schizophrenia research. And it was very powerful for me for the first time to meet the people who are NARSAD. To me, it's no longer a faceless foundation. It's the people who work to keep this alive and have hope that research can change the lives of their loved ones and future generations of people who are susceptible to these illnesses.
That's amazing. So the basic concept here is that all of this research will translate in some way into prevention, cure, all of that kind of better treatment.
Indeed. The people who are suffering now need better treatments. Most people who have a mental illness don't have a treatment that is 100% effective, and there are no cures. That's why we're also focused not just on predicting who will respond well to which treatments, but also trying to find the risk factors so we can intervene before someone expresses these devastating symptoms.
Well, getting back to that whole notion, let's talk about genetic engineering, since that's something with the human genome we have more access to, and it's a terribly slippery slope and an ethical dilemma. But if you could determine what the biomarkers are for a disease like autism and or childhood schizophrenia, would you think it would be wise to counsel people not to go ahead and have a family, for example?
Well, I think we have to be very conservative in this regard. Based on the eugenics movements of early in the 20th century and all it begets about assumptions about genetic causation of mental illness, we have to be very careful. Also, in the recent attempts at genetic engineering for simple, what we call quote-unquote simple Mendelian disorders, they've been less than successful. Now we're talking about disorders where maybe 100, maybe 300 genes are all contributing to someone's risk profile. So rather than engineering one gene, we'd have to engineer a composite of genes, the complexity of which I can't conceive of right now. So I think about it more in terms of not genetic engineering, but identifying treatable targets. Genes, again, make proteins, and if we can identify a host of 300 genes that are deficient in an individual with schizophrenia, we can target a medication that is maybe a composite of 300 ways to offset the genes.
So that type of treatment is really kind of the target, I think.
At this point, I think that's the most realistic target. And we're also trying to identify bottlenecks, the most important genes that may be the best treatable targets, so we can work with hand in hand with pharmaceutical companies to develop better medicines. Right now, the medicines we have for psychiatric disorders are like dropping an anvil on a tack, and really we need that ball peen hammer to just set that nail perfectly. We don't have it, but by understanding the genome, we can identify the risk genes and then target medications that offset only those genes, maybe leading to less side effects too.
And how about when you talk about early diseases of early onset, like autism? It would seem to me that an earlier diagnosis and an earlier opportunity to intervene would make a huge difference. Is that part of what you're hoping to accomplish?
Indeed,
as well?
And the scientific data support this very much for most psychiatric disorders, that the earlier you intervene when someone shows symptoms, the better off they'll be, the better outcome they'll have. So obviously with autism, typically it doesn't get diagnosed until an individual is maybe 3 years old, which is way too late, and it's also way later than they first show symptoms. If we can find something biological at 12 months or at 6 months, we can start interventions at that point in time before they're suffering in their social interactions or preschool.
Seems like you're going to, if you are successful, which I believe you will be, I believe in you.
Thank you.
It seems that you're going to have a very huge impact, not only in maybe the treatment and prevention and some of these things, but maybe enhancing the quality of life for some of these people with mental illness. Do you think that with the advent of an understanding of the biological underpinnings, there's less stigma attached?
Your sense of that? I would like to think that there is, but unfortunately, I think the answer is no. There's not much less stigma than there was 50 years ago. We certainly treat people with mental illnesses differently. There's more formalized attempts in society to reintegrate and to increase the functional capacity of people with mental illnesses. But there's still perceptions out there among many people that these are not on the same par as cancer or heart disease in terms of treatable disorders, biologically based disorders that deserve research and medical treatment and sensitivity.
Well, thank God for an organization like NARSAD.
Indeed.
Then, because it sounds like they're really championing, you'll have to say that for me, they're the champions of this kind of research, and it seems like it really needs to be done.
Indeed, and NARSAD takes risks on research that the conservative National Institutes of Health sometimes don't, so it leads to those once-in-a-lifetime types of breakthroughs.
What do you see for the future? If you had a crystal ball right now, what would you see happening?
Well, what I envision is that maybe 15 years from now, we won't really talk about things like schizophrenia, ADHD, autism, or bipolar disorder anymore. Right now, those diagnoses are collections of symptoms and syndromes. Ultimately, we may diagnose these disorders based on a genetic panel and an understanding of the environmental factors that somebody's been exposed to. So we may have 300 different subtypes of schizophrenia, 300 different subtypes of ADHD, each of which has a separate causation, which also dictates a separate pathway for treatment. We may not have the treatments for all those different subtypes by then, but we may understand that they exist, which would be a monumental leap forward.
It sounds like we're really getting into, we would be well on our way, but I'm just relieved to know that it's no longer the mother's fault.
Indeed, nor the father's.
Or the father's fault. Well, it sounds very exciting. I cannot say how excited I am to have you as part of our upstate community, and the research that you're doing is incredible.
Thank you for your support.
So Dr. Stephen Glatt, director of the Psychiatric Genetic Epidemiology Neurobiology Laboratory, or the PsychGen Lab here at Upstate, thanks for joining us this morning and continuing your wonderful work. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back, so stay right there. I'm Linda Cohen. This is HealthLink on Air, 570 WSYR.